Thank you for coming, Maharaj. Hare Krishna. You're leaving tomorrow, I hear. My loss. When are you coming back? Ah, wonderful, I'll still be here. We can talk more. Hare Krishna. Okay, so I brought a total of 54 stories of Srila Prabhupada between the years of 1971 through to 1977. Of course, 1977 was the demise of Srila Prabhupada's demise of Srila Prabhupada's body, and after 1977 there were still many pastimes enacted, but we're simply concentrating today on the 71 to the 77 when he was here. Is that all right? Okay. It's almost like I'm swallowing the microphone. Anyway. Okay, so we covered 23 stories yesterday. It was quite good, you know, we did well. And there's some stories that I'm not going to talk about tonight. And they're the very intimate stories of Srila Prabhupada. As time grew near to his departing this world, and there was a lead-up of about 6 months up to that time, which were very intimate pastimes, which I'm hoping we can get a final day to do that. Maybe Maharaj can be present when we do that one, you know. So I'd like to sort of carry on and talk about Srila Prabhupada's sense of humor before we get back into what I called yesterday the thunderbolt mode of getting everything ready for a particular date, which was actually, it was before Ram Navami that Srila Prabhupada wanted the temple open, but for whatever reason, and as I said, you can't make excuses. Prabhupada never wanted to hear excuses. If it is better that you just say, I'm sorry Srila Prabhupada, I failed you, or Srila Prabhupada, I'm just foolish and I'm just hopeless at everything that I do. Because I was reading this afternoon up in my room that is the mood of the disciple in front of the spiritual master. He always has to present himself as a fool. And that's what we try to do most of the time, is present ourselves as fools. And if we didn't...
That's what we are.
We are. And if we didn't, then Srila Prabhupada would make it very known that we were very good at reminding us. Anyway, Srila Prabhupada, and this is about Kishori, and it's a shame that she's not here, but anyway, Srila Prabhupada, one of the things that he liked eating most was kachoris. And Srila Prabhupada once said that one of the reasons that I'm looking forward to going back to the spiritual world is so I can relish Radharani's kachoris again. Because in the spiritual world, it's all increasing. The energy is very different from the energy that we experience in the material world. Material energy, as Krishna describes, is inferior energy. It is inferior energy. So in the spiritual sky, in the Vaikuntha planets and on Krishna Goloka Vrindavan, the energy is ever increasing. So if you eat something, then when you eat that same thing again, it'll be even nicer. And it goes on and on and on. And we can't imagine that, can't we? We just can't imagine something being ever increasingly relishable to take. So there wasn't many devotees that can make kachoris like Prabhupada liked to eat. But Kishori, bless her heart, she was very, very good at making kachoris. Of course, the kitchen was like World War III, by the time she'd finished making anything in the kitchen. That was the nature of her execution, that she was very passionate in the kitchen. But anyway, the end result was incredible. So Prabhupada loved to eat kachoris, and actually he wasn't really allowed to eat kachoris. The doctor says you can't eat kachoris, you can't eat fatty foods, and Prabhupada exhibited from time to time this little naughty cowherd boy attitude. And he would say, don't talk to me about nutrition. He says, I don't want to hear, he says, I don't understand anything about nutrition. Don't talk to me about it, you know. He says, I just like to take Krishna prasadam. And I remember there was one devotee, he was, when Prabhupada was visiting Los Angeles, I think it was, and this devotee was opening a temple, but he had friends that were just vegetarians. And this particular devotee wanted to, Prabhupada to come to this particular person's vegetarian restaurant. And I think he had also vegan items, you know. And Prabhupada says, I'm not really interested in nutrition. I'm not interested even in vegetarianism. He says, vegetarian and meat eating actually are on the same level. And what he meant by that was that it's sinful. If we eat anything that we don't offer to Krishna, it has the result of being sinful, the reaction. So Prabhupada said, I am not interested in vegetarian restaurant. I am interested in a restaurant that is serving prasadam. That is all. So that is one of the things that Prabhupada liked. Also, and I was personally present when this happened, we were talking about we were talking about Srila Prabhupada's dear friend in Vrindavan, Bhagaji, Vishwamba Dayal. And one morning Prabhupada called him, and Prabhupada was out in his back garden. He was sitting at this lotus pond here, and Prabhupada whispered in Bhagaji's ear so no one else could hear, and he said, can you get me some of those green chilies from the market, you know, those little green, very very hot, you know. Oof. And Bhagaji looked at Prabhupada and said, but Prabhupada, you don't say anything. He said, I want you to get me some green chilies. And that was the naughtiness of Prabhupada. He was, and then I came in to the garden to say something to Prabhupada, and this conversation was going on, and Prabhupada and Bhagaji were laughing at one another and talking in Hindi. And in those days I didn't really understand a lot of Hindi. But Bhagaji later on told me that Srila Prabhupada was trying to get him to buy chilies at the market. And I think he did bring some, and he ate maybe one or two with his prasadam, you know. So that was another thing. And then Bhagaji would also make feasts in his house, because his house was just around the corner. And he would always invite Srila Prabhupada. On this particular time, Brahmananda was present. And we were all sitting around Bhagaji's house, his courtyard. It's not very big, but I think there was at least 25, 30 devotees sitting with Prabhupada, taking prasadam. And Brahmananda was next, sitting next to Prabhupada. And during the course of eating, say within 50 minutes of the start of, Brahmananda said, Srila Prabhupada wants more chapatis. Bring more chapatis for Prabhupada. And Prabhupada looked at Brahmananda and he says, I want more chapatis? I don't want more chapatis. It means you want more chapatis. So then Prabhupada said that if someone says, bring chapatis for a second person, it means actually that they want the chapatis and not the second person. So this became a very big topic during our eating then. Brahmananda was very explicit in saying in front of everybody that Prabhupada wanted more chapatis. So Prabhupada thought, I'm not going to let him get away with that. I'm also going to be explicit back and tell him that I don't want any chapatis in front of everyone else also. So that was very embarrassing for Brahmananda, because then Bhagavad Gita caught on to the joke and brought Brahmananda about 10 chapatis to make sure he had enough, you know. It was very funny, that interaction. You'd have to be there to really appreciate the funniness of it. But because, you know, when Vaishnavas sit down and take prasadam, particularly in this instance in Bhagavad Gita's house, the chapatis were always fresh and hot, come right off the stove with a little ghee, and they were given like that, you know. But this particular time, Bhagavad Gita collected about 10, and he came. They were on a plate, and he just said, here's the chapatis that you want. And Prabhupada laughed, because he says, now you have to eat them all. He said, you can't get up unless you eat them all. So that was that. Another funny thing, and what we're talking about at the moment, is the sense of humor of Srila Prabhupada. He was the supreme entertainer. And it was incredible to sit back and watch Prabhupada perform. And at this particular time, there was a Sanskrit scholar that came to see Prabhupada. And he was a very tall gentleman with a very long beard, and very, very well dressed person, sadhu looking, sadhu type, but very well dressed. And then Prabhupada just, you know, he greeted him, Hare Krishna, and the Sanskrit scholar started talking in Sanskrit. And of course Prabhupada's disciples couldn't understand what was happening, what he was saying. And then Prabhupada went on speaking to him in Hindi. And then the Sanskrit scholar remained speaking in Sanskrit. Then Prabhupada changed from Hindi to Bengali. Then Prabhupada started talking to the Sanskrit scholar in Bengali. And the Sanskrit scholar replied still in Sanskrit, even though he could understand Bengali and Hindi. So what Prabhupada did, which was very funny, when the Sanskrit scholar started talking, because at the point he was talking for quite some time, it must have been about two, three minutes, when you're in the moment, moments can be very long actually, you know, time can slow down, and 3 minutes can be a lot of moments. And we're all thinking, oh, you know, Prabhupada's changing his language, but this person is carrying on in Sanskrit. No one can understand what he was saying except for Prabhupada. So at a point, Prabhupada ignored him and didn't respond. And then he started again talking in Sanskrit. And basically, I think he was basically showing his prowess at knowing the Sanskrit language. So then all of a sudden Prabhupada started talking in English, and he didn't stop talking in English, because the Sanskrit scholar couldn't understand English. And Prabhupada wanted him to share with his disciples what he was also saying to Prabhupada, but he wouldn't do that. So Prabhupada thought, okay, I'll start speaking in English. And he couldn't understand English. So finally he got up and walked out. And Prabhupada said, Jesse, he said, you know, I was trying to be respectful. I wanted him to converse in a language that maybe you could have understood. But of course he couldn't speak English. But at least he could have stopped speaking Sanskrit and talked to me in Hindi and Bengali. And I was just going through these languages just to see. So finally, that was quite funny, because if you would have been sitting there, when Prabhupada started talking about English, he started talking about Lord Chaitanya's movement and the fact that Lord Chaitanya's message is being spread all over the world. And as a result, all these boys and girls are here present in the room this evening. But it happened that he wouldn't reply, and finally he just got up and walked out. And that was that. But Prabhupada, after he walked out, Prabhupada turned to us all and he started smiling and saying that, what is the use of Sanskrit? What is the use of it? It's not a universal language, and it's not a language that you can really, even though we learn Sanskrit slokas, because when we talk in English about the philosophy, it's good to back it up. Prabhupada always wanted his disciples or whoever was preaching to quote Shastra after they'd spoke. And that way it's reconfirming that what you're saying is actually a fact. That's Shruti. Shruti Smriti Puranadi Pancharatra Vidimbina Akantaki Hari Bhakti Upatayeva Kalpate. So Prabhupada also mentioned that when we are writing, because Prabhupada also encouraged writing, we should all write. But Prabhupada said the benchmark is the Shruti. It has to be within the confines of Shruti, which is the Vedic scriptures. Because if it's not, and one does their own thing and tries to produce some assumptions or mental speculation during their reading or their writing, then it becomes an unnecessary burden on society. So that sloka is all about being very careful. Shruti, Smriti. Smriti is what is our writing, is what we can write. But it has to be in line with Shruti. And in that way, it's very bona fide and very parampara. So that was that. I'm just going through the SOHs. Right, this is a good story. Okay. There is a and I'm going to talk in an anonymous way. I don't want to use the name in case there could be offense of some kind. So, but it's not derogatory what I'm going to say. It's just a fun type of interaction. There was one disciple of Prabhupada in Vrindavan, and he got to the point where he felt that he was so agitated, his mind was so agitated, that there was a certain influence that was causing it. And instead of going to Srila Prabhupada and talking it through, he decided to go to an astrologer, a local astrologer. And the local astrologer told him that in a previous life he was a mouse in the temple, okay? And mouse used to just run around and take prasadam, and as a result that's why he's got a human form today. But he said, in your human form you are very influenced by the planet Rahu. So to counteract the influences of Rahu, you must wear this. And it was like a little, what you call them, a little silver container. Yes, with bits of different items in it. But it was very tight around his neck, and it was like a nylon thread, you know. And I saw it and I'm thinking, that's dangerous, to wear such a tight necklace like that, plastic. Anyway, he had it around his neck. When he went in to see Prabhupada one day with other devotees present, Prabhupada asked him, what is that around your neck? And then he related the story to Srila Prabhupada, and Srila Prabhupada said, there is no need to go to astrologers. Why are you going to astrologers? Don't you have faith in Krishna? Don't you realize who Krishna is? He said, you know, with Krishna's little pinky, and he referred to the little toe on the foot. He said, with a little, just a little slight kick, with a little toe, Krishna can destroy thousands of Rahu planets. And he emphasized it. He became very explicit. Thousands of planets. Savadaman Bhurchaja Mamikam Zaranam Raja. And as Prabhupada was saying that, he was trying to get hold of the thread and break it off his neck. And it was very, very difficult because it was nylon, and I was afraid that he was going to cut his fingers, you know. But just being in Prabhupada's presence, just for 5 minutes, for Prabhupada to be able to relate to him about the strength of Krishna, that he, just with his little pinky toe, he can kick and destroy thousands of Rahus, what to speak of this one Rahu planet. So then, finally he said, Savadaman Purjaja Mami Kamsa, you surrender to Krishna, like that. So, when he left the room, Srila Prabhupada started to laugh really loudly, because I guess Prabhupada was envisioning Krishna kicking thousands of Rahu planets with his little toe, you know. And then we all started laughing because Prabhupada looked so beautiful, you know, the way he was laughing about this particular incident. And then we carried on that interaction with Prabhupada, and then Prabhupada started to relate about Krishna and his creation. And Prabhupada said, Krishna is so in love with you, with all the living entities, the marginal energy. He said, Krishna has inferior energy, and that inferior energy has been used in making this playhouse. It's like a playhouse for us to play in, because we have decided, we have desired to try to enjoy without Krishna. So with his inferior energy, he sets up the playhouse for us, so we can play. And we can play whatever games we want. But then, within the playhouse, because Krishna is so attached to us, he comes himself. Every millennium, in his original transcendental form, he sends his Purusha avatars. Think of the work involved. Through all the Purusha avatars, the creation, the destruction, the maintenance, Nityo Nityanam, Chaitanas Chaitanam, he is that one person who is supplying us all the food to eat, all the water to drink, the air to breathe. This is all for us to just be in this playhouse playing. At the same time, then he sends Lila avatars into each and every universe to try to attract us back again. Paritranaya sadunam. That's the main reason why all these Lila avatars come into the material world. It's because it is to attract us back to home, back to Godhead. Then there are so many other avatars, Yuga avatars, Manvantara avatars, spiritual masters. Even Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself came. And why? Because Krishna is so madly in love with us that he doesn't want us suffering in this playhouse. He doesn't want us to remain here in this material world. So think of the energy that's employed in running after us, in a sense. You want this? Okay. It's not going to be too good. It's not as good as living where you are now, but take it. You know, you have to learn the hard way. Take it. But at the same time, the amount of energy that Krishna invests, Prabhupada says Krishna loves us so much, he's prepared to go into the lowest species of life. For us, that's very derogatory, to be born a serpent or or some very lowly species, and there are plenty of those. Because Krishna, in Bhagavad Gita, he considers the 8,400,000 different species of life as not a place to go. Because when Arjuna was asking Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, what if one doesn't complete the process? What happens? Am I just like a riven cloud that is just left to rot? And Prabhupada said, no. So he says, it behooves you, because a little advancement on this path can protect you from the dangerous type of fear. And what is the dangerous type of fear? That you go back into the 8,400,000 different species of life. So the human form of life, there is incredible emphasis on the importance of the human form of life, because it doesn't come about very often. Prabhupada says it is very, very, forget Vaishnava, just to have a human form of life is extremely, extremely rare, and Prabhupada emphasizes it over and over again. Brahmanda Brahmate Kona Bhagavan Jeev. The jiva is wandering around these universes. And Prabhupada mentioned that if we take a mustard seed, just one little mustard seed, you can just gauge that as a universe, right? With just say a four-headed Brahma. And Prabhupada said four directions is very, very small in a universe. When Brahma has 1,000 heads, hundreds of thousands of heads, that's a big universe, because there are hundreds of thousands of directions. So Prabhupada said that the total Mahatattva, the total conglomeration of all the universes put together, right, is likened to a 25 kilo bag of mustard seeds. Now, can you imagine how many mustard seeds could we ever count, even in one 25 kilo gunny sack? Could we count how many mustard seeds there are? How is it possible? But this is the length and breadth and it's used as like an analogy, just to describe the immensity of the Mahatattva, of which we are in a small universe. We are in a four-headed Brahma universe. So just imagine the emphasis. So important the human form of life is. So how fortunate we are. We are all sitting here tonight in Vrindavan. How fortunate is that? And we've gone from taking a human form of life. Just like when Lord Chaitanya was speaking to Rupa Goswami, at Dasa Vimeda Ghat in Allahabad, he was emphasizing to Rupa Goswami that the science of love of God is like a huge ocean, and we can't calculate the length and the breadth of that huge ocean of love of God. So let me just take a drop of that ocean and explain to you. And that was the conversation between Rupa Goswami and Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya, in that conversation, emphasized that the human being, out of all the 8,400,000 different species of life, the human being is very, 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 very small percentage. And then when you take a human form of life, Lord Chaitanya again is emphasizing in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya that there are human animals. It's not the criteria to think that, oh, I've got a human body, I'm a human being. It's what you do, it's the consciousness that you develop while you're in the human form. So the criteria of being a human being starts with Vana Ashram Dham. What to speak of all the other things. And that's why Prabhupada was very, very strong about establishing Vana Ashram Dham. And that's why Prabhupada was always emphasizing a lot of the time especially here in Vrindavan and Mayapur, and all these projects that were very, very dear to Prabhupada, his book distribution. You talk to all the devotees that were working in the printing press in Los Angeles, the pressures they were under. Well, Prabhupada was, he was going gung-ho. It was like he was translating so much, day in and day out, night in, night out. Prabhupada was translating and sending all these, they were cassettes in those days, weren't they? They weren't CDs, you know. And we were also under pressure building the temple. Prabhupada didn't pussyfoot around with us. He wasn't the rose. He was the thunderbolt. Do it. Pressure. Because he knew the spiritual master. He's connected to the Daivim Prakritim. He is not under the influences of the three modes of material nature. And as a result, and I'm going to tell you a story to show this is how factual this is what I'm saying, is that the spiritual master can see past, present and future. The bona fide spiritual master. And I'll go straight on to that story now, because when Srila Prabhupada would come to visit us, one of the visiting times, and this shook us all, but it shook us in a very nice way. And what Srila Prabhupada said was that there is not a thing that I do that is not driven by the Supersoul within my heart. He says, everything that I do, I say, is Supersoul driven. I am in complete union with the Supersoul. That is the form intelligence. In the second chapter, in Lord in the Heart, in Srimad Bhagavatam, it explains incredibly how Prabhupada has laid out this very extensive purport about the Lord in the Heart and how you can actually perceive the Lord through the intelligence. You know, people say you probably heard this, even the layman, well, it's from the layman, they say, I've got this gut feeling. You know, have you ever heard people say that? I've got this feeling, and it's almost like they've been given intelligence by the Supersoul to perform a particular activity, but because they have no knowledge, they don't, and probably what they heard was it wasn't loud either, it was very subtle. Because the more Krishna consciousness you become, Prabhupada says, actually you see the Supersoul. You see him right there in the heart, because he's sitting right next to you. So Prabhupada was very explicit in telling us, and there were about, at that time, I would say there were about 15 devotees working on the construction of the temple. So Prabhupada, as a result of him saying that, Prabhupada said, he instructed Gurudas, because Gurudas was there, and Jamuna were there, he says, I want you to arrange small groups of devotees, of my disciples. And he says, we will go on a walk, and at that time it was the Chittakara Road, not the Bhaktivedanta Mark, and we will sit under a tree, very peacefully, and I want every disciple that comes in groups to ask me questions, inquire from me, give me inquiries about any doubts, anything that you want to clear up. Because my position as your bona fide spiritual master is I am totally in unison with the Supersoul within my heart. And that gave us, like we were talking, that was like hot off the press. That was like, you know, straight out of Prabhupada's mouth. So that went like wildfire all over the world very quickly, you know, through one devotee to another devotee that were passing through. And, you know, that's the fortune of having Vapu. But like I said over and over again, and I will repeat this over and over again, that I am honored to be in your association, because did anyone here have any association with Prabhupada? Diti? Yeah, good. So how many? So, right. So, I feel that for one to take up Vani, and I know in the room here there's a lot of younger devotees, and are there devotees here under the age of 25? Okay, there's a few. If you consider all over the world there are many young devotees, and they have faith. So I can only be in awe and reverence at the fact that you have had no association physically with Prabhupada, but at the same time you embrace the sound vibration of Vani, and that's incredible. You know, that really is wonderful. So there's that one. Right. As the project started to really take form, not just the temple but the guest house here, and it started rising up, the basic structure. And one time Prabhupada was visiting, and we would have, because on the actual construction of the temple, there was a lot of work going on. At one point, and this lasted for about, I would say, at least the last 6 months prior to the opening of the temple, we had over 300 artisans working round the clock, 7 days a week. And we had this place lit up like a Christmas tree, lit up like you can't believe the amount of lights. It was like daylight 24/7. So it was so noisy. So we started to come to the back side, and there was a lot more quiet for Prabhupada to do whatever he wanted to do with us in the evening. On this occasion, and it happens that sometimes Prabhupada would spring something on you. You know, you always had to be on your guard, in a sense. You know, of course you never were, you know. But Prabhupada would ask you to give class. And that's terrifying. You know. Prabhupada will be sitting, and I remember this particular time. I think there were about 10 of us present. And Prabhupada sang Jaya Radha Madhava. You know, we thought we were just going to sit and listen to Prabhupada giving class. And then all of a sudden, he asked, and I'll tell you who he asked. It was Trivikram Swami. You all know Trivikram Swami, Maharaj?
Yes.
Trivikram Maharaj. And he's a wonderful person, Trivikram. I have so much respect for him. So he was like dumbstruck. I remember his face right now. I can see it. You know, you're like, oh God, you know. Why me? You know, why you pick me? You know? Why don't you pick someone else? You know? So he was asked to give a talk. And so I was thinking, oh, you know, so glad it wasn't me, you know. And Trivikram Maharaj became so nervous because it was very spontaneous. Prabhupada had asked him to do this particular thing. And somehow or other he froze, and he couldn't string a sentence together. I felt so sorry for him, you know. I wanted the crack to open up in the floor to swallow us all, you know. It's like, but he persisted, and that was the thing. And he persisted, and he persisted, and he persisted, and finally he was managing to get something together, but still it was very incoherent. You couldn't really really understand what he was getting at, really. It was just coming out of his mouth. And that went on for about 20 minutes, and finally Maharaj said, "Is there any questions?" And there was silence, you know, no one had any questions. And then he stood up, Maharaj stood up, and then Prabhupada got up out of his chair, and he went over to Maharaj and he embraced Trivikram so warmly, you know, he just embraced him like that. And it was so heart-wrenching, you know, we were all crying and we're thinking how kind Srila Prabhupada is, that he saw his devotees struggling, trying to please, and he endeavored, he tried, but he was overwhelmed by the presence of his spiritual master. So Prabhupada in response just hugged him. And it was a hug that went on for, I would say, at least a minute. That's a long time. So whenever you see Trivikram Maharaj, you know, you can ask him. Because I would have gone through that for a hug. I would have definitely, I thought, oh, I wish Prabhupada had asked me now to give class. You know, I would have been good. I would have had this hug, you know. That was Prabhupada. He was very warm and gentle, you know. And that was the rose, you see. We're talking about the rose. Prabhupada exhibited the rose, and then he can exhibit the thunderbolt. So that was a perfect opportunity for the rose, you know. Lovely. So I've got to mention Guru Kripa, because bless his heart, he went to Japan. Prabhupada initiated him as a sannyasi, Guru Kripa Swami, and then his associate Yasodhanandan Swami, they were like two peas in a pod. They were very funny characters, you know. Does anyone know Guru Kripa? Yasodhananda? Yeah. How long have you known?
I remember them when I was a brahmachari in San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah, they're funny. Well, they used to say, one time they said, call us the Boston Stranglers, you know. They were very sort of, they had this intensity about them, you know, and they were like, you know, really raw personalities, you know, they were like gung-ho and raw and really passionate and, you know. So Prabhupada gave them this engagement that, you know, instead of asking temples, the BBT funds, to give to filter money through to build the Vrindavan project, Prabhupada said once and for all, Guru Kripa, you have a big party of brahmacharis, the Namhat they were called, so you and the Namhat, you go to Japan and collect. And off they went, and they were collecting like incredible sums of money. I think they were one of the first, you know, traveling parties that were collecting. They broke through the barrier, money sums in terms of income collected. They were collecting hundreds of thousands of dollars, and in those days it was a huge amount of money to collect. And so as a result, what they used to do is come periodically to Vrindavan to recoup. And we would have the most incredible kirtans, because we were all in it together. You know, we were there building intensely, because Prabhupada put the squeeze on us, you can't believe. You know, we were under a microscope. In Vrindavan, you are anyway. You're under a microscope. Prabhupada said, 3 days service in Vrindavan is like 3 years service in the West. If you come to Vrindavan and serve in the Dham, you get benefits big time. But again, if you do operad in the Dham, that cancels out. So you have to be very mindful And Prabhupada was saying that when you come to Vrindavan, you have to live in the mood of Goswami. And that's why Prabhupada had us living in these little huts during the construction of the temple. So Guru Kripa, he brought Prabhupada a lot of Lakshmi, and Guru Kripa, he loved to be able to give it to Prabhupada directly. That was his thing, you know. Let me give whatever I collect to Prabhupada. And he used to bring loads of cash, you know, loads and loads of bundles, you know, and he used to love putting it on Prabhupada's lap, and it would all flow over, and you know, and Prabhupada would be looking at this, and oh, that was wonderful. And he'd pat him on the head, you know. Yeah, it was incredible. And then Guru Kripa would go out, and he kept on going back and forth, collecting all this money, until eventually he just couldn't do it anymore. And I remember him with Srila Prabhupada in the room, he was crying like a little baby, saying, "Please, Prabhupada, don't send me back to Japan, I just can't do it anymore." You know, it just became really difficult. And then Prabhupada says, "No, no, you have to go." So I think he went maybe once or twice more, and then that was that. But Prabhupada was always very, very kind to Guru Kripa Maharaj and Yasodhanand Maharaj for their contribution to this temple and other temples. Also, the money was also being sent to Mayapur. So whenever you see Guru Kripa and Yasodhanand, and you always you validate to them that you appreciate what they've done. It's good. Oh. Okay. I think I said yesterday that myself and Sarabi, who's coming very soon, you like Sarabi. He's a very tall person and very humble and very, very, very creative person, very sensitive, you know. And we didn't have an ordinary temple life day to day. We were building temples. We didn't have it. So what we, our temple in Vrindavan, because Prabhupada didn't like us, to be honest, I'll say this, he wasn't fond of us going on our own out into Vrindavan. Prabhupada used to say, there's too many elements there to disturb you, and you wait for me to come and I'll take you to the six Goswami temples. But he says, you know, don't make it a habit of going out on your own. So as a result, we used to try to find moments, particularly, you know, after 6 o'clock, we used to sit on piles of sand and stone chips, and we used to learn Bhagavad Gita slokas. That was our way of filling our time, you know. And I got into the habit of doing that because of Guru Kripa and Yasodhanandan. Particularly Yasodhanandan Swami, he was very, very erudite, very scholarly person. And he knew so many slokas, and he used to do a lot of preaching in South India. And in South India, you've got that scholarly, you know, with the Ramanuja devotees, you know. I know that Yasodhanandan Maharaj, he took many photographs because he used to visit all the big temples in South and associate with the sadhus and the devotees in different sampradayas there. And they're very erudite and very learned. And Prabhupada liked that, and he used to show Yasodhananda Maharaj off to visitors, right? Because he became almost like a walking encyclopedia of philosophy. He was able to talk very, very nicely the philosophy. So Prabhupada would always take advantage of his presence and say, "This is my disciple, Yasodhananda Maharaj." Then, why don't you speak a little to these people? You know, if there were some important guests. And Yasodhananda Maharaj used to talk about his travels, and in the process of doing that, he always would talk philosophically about things too. So I always think from time to time about Guru Kripa and Yasodhananda because of their contribution to this temple. Wonderful. And when Prabhupada used to come, we went to take prasadam also over to Narayan Maharaj's mat in Mathura. And that was a nice exchange also, because Prabhupada took sannyas in Mathura, in that mat. And we went there and took wonderful prasadam one day with Prabhupada. And, I don't know, Gaudiya Math are very, very expert at making prasad. And I'm just going to tell a story about Prabhupada's godbrother that stayed with us on the land during the construction. And Prabhupada was delighted that he was able to come and stay with us, and his name was Anand Prabhu. And he was a nice Tikka Brahmachari. He'd been Brahmachari all his life. And from the day, he said, ever since he's known, even his mother used to rub mustard oil in his skin, all over, from tip to toe. And then he got into the habit of doing it himself. And his body was really shiny. It was like a polished shoe, you know? Really shiny. And he used to climb trees. He must have been about 75 years old at that point. But he was very active. And he used to go into the forest. I mean, in those days, there was some forest around here. What's happened to it all? I mean, I haven't been here for 17 years. And even 17 years ago, it seemed like there was more greenery. And now it's all concrete, isn't it? It's incredible how... It's almost like... I see it as the sun shining, because the Dham is the Dham. Chintamani, Prakarasadna, Su, Kalpavik. The Dham is the Dham. But just like the sun is the sun, how powerful it is. But clouds can cover the sun. So here in Vrindavan you have these layers of materialism in the form of concrete, and it's the consciousness of people. And you see, you only got to go to the roadside, and it's like another world, isn't it? You look out of the compound and it's like, oh. You don't feel like going out there, you know. It's like you stay inside. So Anand Prabhu, he would look after us, Sarabhi and myself, and he was always afraid that we'd get sick. So he used to make us things that would keep our health robust. And one morning, it was a winter's morning, and you know how cold it can get in Vrindavan in the winter, and it's very misty. It was a very misty, cold morning. And Anand Prabhu, he was living in a little hut just next to our huts, and he was on the mortar and pestle, and he was mixing up some potent this or that. I don't know what he was doing. But then he said, "Plum, plum." Because in those days we didn't know a lot of Hindi, and Anand obviously couldn't speak English, but we still communicated fantastic, you know. So he called us like this early in the morning. We go into his little hut, and he gave us like parcels. They were like leaves. It was like, you know, pan. People chew pan. It was almost like that, but more. And I've never seen these leaves before. They weren't neem leaves, right? So I was reluctant to sort of put it in my mouth, but we did. And we tried chewing it, right? And it was, so they were all, it was all leaves folded together like a parcel of leaves. And it was only in my mouth for about 20 seconds, and I was thinking, oh God, I wanted to vomit. It was so strong, I don't know what he'd given me. And I looked at Sarabi, and he was feeling exactly the same way. We're like, you know, what's this? What has he given us? What has he given us? And what he'd given us is he found leaves. He knows all these plants, and, you know, and he'd put about 10 to 12 whole pepper kernels as the center of the parcel. And then around those kernels, he built these leaves into a parcel. And they were the most bitter leaves you can imagine. They were much bitter than neem leaves. I don't know where he got them from. But he expected us to just eat them like as if nothing, huh? You know, like, it's all right, it's only some peppercorns and, you know, some leaves. Anyway, we spat it out. We just couldn't deal with it. You know. Out it went, you know. And he was laughing, and he says, I know. Oh, no problem. So next morning, there he is in his little kitchen again, you know. And I thought, oh, what's he going to give us today, you know. So what he had done, he had got the same ingredients, the peppercorns, the leaves, but then he got gur, right? And then he made these laddus. And they were fantastic. And we were going, oh, I hope he can give us more of those. And we used to, he didn't have to ask us in the end. We used to go and say, have you got any more of those, that medicine, you know? And I remember it was Bhijma's disappearance day, okay? And the Nan Prabhu was famous in the Gaudiya Math for cooking exactly what each devotee would like. I guess it's in the Shastra somewhere. I don't know where. Maybe someone can tell. Do you know, Maharaj? You know when these leelas happen with, like, Bhishma was leaving, he had all the arrows in his body, you know? Bhishma liked a particular prasadam to eat. There were certain things that he'd like to eat, and you'd make it on the disappearance day. And it was like that with a lot of appearance and disappearance of these personalities. So on one this particular day was Bhishma's disappearance day. And he made this incredible preparation. Today, after that one time, I've never had it again since. But what it was like, I'll describe it to you, it was like dokla. You know dokla? How it's like spongy, you know? Well, this was like in a dark, like a gravy. It almost looked like a Western sort of gravy, you know, that they make. And it was the most incredible taste. And the gravy wasn't like a loose gravy, it was more concentrated because he kept it going on top of the heat. And when he served it, and with puris, oh. And I remember him, and he would laugh. He had this sort of really screechy laugh, you know. And he would love making prasadam for us, honestly. He was like, you can't imagine what it was like. It was so wonderful to have all these preparations that you would never get otherwise. Prabhupada introduced the basics to us, and we were able to do that. And then we learned, like Jamuna, she learned so many things. Prabhupada used to say she is a Vedic cook. Prabhupada considered Jamuna a Vedic cook. Because in Shruti Kirti's book, What is the Difficulty? You read that where he's making prasad for Prabhupada, and Prabhupada says, you make American prasadam. He said, it is very nice, but I like Yamuna's prasadam because it's Vedic. And he said, so I want you to come and have lunch with me today. And this was in his rooms at Radha Damodar temple. And Prabhupada was, and they're very humble rooms, you know, that Prabhupada lived in. And there was that little kitchen, and Yamuna was in there making prasadam, and she she brought in Prabhupada's plate, and Prabhupada was just swooning, eating these preparations that Yamuna had made. And then Prabhupada said, now you sit. He said to Shruti Kirti, you sit, and Yamuna will bring in a plate for you, and you can tell the difference between how you cook and how she cooks. And because she's serving you today, then some other time you have to cook for her. So she brought in this prasadam, plate of prasadam, and Shruti Kirti was like, oh yeah, I can understand. It's like chalk and cheese, you know. Like, oh. Anyway, so Anand, getting back to the story, Anand Prabhu, he lived with us, I think, for about 2.5 years on the land, and he was constantly... I remember in the summer he would make this incredible, like, drink, and I don't know what the flower was, but they were high up in a tree, and there weren't many of these trees in Vrindavan, but he sourced the tree, he knew where the trees were, and he used to pick these very, they were like trumpets, you know, and they were bright yellow, so it would start thin and it would go out like that. And he'd pick them, bring them down, and he would, you know, and he'd mix it with water, ice water, and some other ingredients, and it was the most nectarine drink you can imagine. And again, I don't know how he does all these things, but that was his occupation. He loved cooking, you know, he loved cooking. So that's Anand Prabhu, and... And this is cooking. Right. Okay. Oh yeah. Another thing that exists no longer, and I was so fortunate to be able to experience this. Is the microphone near enough?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's associating with the great sadhus. Krishna Das, Babaji Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, and 3, 4, 5 of his other godbrothers, some sannyasi godbrothers, some grihastha godbrothers. And sometimes they would come on the land and they would get together in a little group and just talk Krishna Katha. And we would sit away listening, just observing. Sometimes we couldn't hear, but they would laugh and joke. And particularly Krishna Das Babaji. And do you know anything about Krishna Das Babaji Maharaj at all? He was always laughing like a little cowherd boy. And I remember when he used to come to the land, he used to go into Prabhupada's room constantly and just laugh. And he had his japa mala. He was a Babaji. He was in white. He had white cloth. He chanted many names every day. But his one of his main characteristics was that he would laugh a lot. And Prabhupada then would laugh. And when you see them together, you would wonder, wow, what are they laughing at? You know? So I miss those interactions because you don't see those anymore, those sadhus, they're gone. They were pure devotees, you know, walking this planet. But we have Maharaj. We have Maharaj. You can see how saintly Maharaj is just by looking at him. Is that right or not? So one sadhu leaves and another one comes, you know. So We're blessed to have you, Maharaj. We really appreciate your association. I'll tell you a funny story. This is in the beginning, before we even started the construction work. We were just living on the land very simply in these humble dwellings and living very, very austerely. We had no money, and our business was only to somehow or other hope that we could start work on the construction as soon as possible. So within our limited budget, what we would do at the peak of the afternoon, we would take it in turns to go on a pedal on a bicycle, and we would wrap ourselves in these wet cloths like a mummy. And we would have to cycle down to Loy Bazaar to the ice walla, because there were no other shops in those days. It was like right to the end of Loy Bazaar, and there was a shop that was selling blocks of ice. So we used to pedal down as quick as we could because of the loo, the wind, the hot wind and the high temperature, and wrapped around all these wet cloths, you know, and come back as soon as possible. And then while that was happening, a devotee would be in this makeshift kitchen on the land making something, cutting up watermelon or, you know, making something light and refreshing. And then we would have a drink every day, like it could be a Nimbupani or something like that, but we'd need the ice. So this one time is really funny, you know. We had cut up all the watermelon and shared it out, but for whatever reason, the devotee that went to get the ice this particular day was not coming back. And the devotee in question, his name was Viala. Do you remember Viala? He's from Los Angeles in the very early days. And he was very, very dark skinned. And again, his skin shone like he had really shiny, very dark skin. And he was immaculately dressed. Even though he had simple attire, his clothes were very simple, but he was always very concerned about how they sat on his body. And he used to spend quite a lot of time making sure he was very presentable, you know. And he used to wash his clothes a lot, so they would always be very white, you know. So he went off, and it was funny because he wore glasses, and he was very dark, so when he was wrapped around with all the white cloth and just this part of his face, he looked really funny, you know, with his glasses on. Anyway, he went off to get the ice. In the meantime, it took so long for him to come back, we'd already eaten our watermelon, and his watermelon was in the kitchen area. You had to go through this little door, and there it was on the floor, and it was covered with a leaf plate. Okay. So eventually, in comes Viara, damn! You know, he's a black American devotee, you know, from New York, I think LA or New York, whatever. And he was very expressive when he spoke, and he was complaining that he had the tire was flat or something like that, and he had to find a pump and pump it up, and he didn't have a pump, and he had to try it. Anyway, by the time he got back, there was the ice, the block of ice was about that big. You know, it went from that to that, you know. And he was also hungry. You know, he said, oh, damn. You know, my drink, I don't have my drink. I haven't had prasadam. And he was really agitated, right? And as we were talking, we just said, oh, it's calm down. You know, you've got your watermelon there. There's loads to eat, don't worry. And as he was talking, he was trying to get all this cloth off him. And all of a sudden this cow appeared, right? Very gently walking towards the kitchen, right? To the point where we realized what was happening. It was beelining for Viala's prasad, right? Now he's already upset. and here's the cow going in for the kill. Got to eat his prasadam. And he was desperately, we all ran to try to stop the cow from going through the door. Right? We were, you know, I was sort of on the side trying to push it one way, and there was another devotee, had his tail. Anyway, the cow, he just stood his ground, and then he went in there, and he ate Viala's watermelon. And then it was such a small room, the cow somehow or other managed to turn back around to come out. And he managed to do it, but his body was getting squeezed as he was coming out. And just as he stepped out, the back side of his, you know, the two back legs, he passed through and blew out his plate. So he left his melon, and then left him with a plate full of stool. And we were cracking, we were so, I mean, we couldn't help laugh, and Viala was just beside himself, you know, he was so upset with that cow. and things like that happened a lot in Vrindavan, you know, there's always, like, reactions that you have to face. I mean, if I look back on all the things that happened to me, out of foolishness, doing silly things. Like, I thought, as a young brahmachari, and they were very cheap, the mangoes, you know, I like mangoes. And I thought, well, why don't I have two mangoes for breakfast, and I'll have another three for lunch, and that'll do me. You know, because they were big mangoes, they were cheap. They were something like 30 paisa, something like that in those days. It was early 70s. Yeah, you know, but they were fantastic mangoes. And very quickly I learned, very, very quickly I learned, because within 3 days I had the biggest boils you could imagine all over my body. And they were like huge things and very, very painful. And when eventually they were lanced, because I went to the doctor to get them lanced and squeezed out, they left craters in my body. It was like a crater was there, you know. So that was one thing. But, you know, I think I've had, you know, dysentery. We all got that, you know. Hepatitis. I had chronic malaria. I think I probably had suffered with every thing that you could get in Vrindavan. And you see me now, and I'm quite large now, right? But in those days, I was very, very thin. Very thin. I used to turn sideways, you couldn't see me. Right? Because of all the diseases. I got the life sucked out of me. I was like, when I had chronic malaria, my blood count was like -6. A good, healthy blood count is something like a 5 or a 6, but I had a -6. And in those days, there was nothing to cure malaria. I think they invented, right at the end, primaquine and chloroquine to cure malaria, which I managed to have in the end. But yeah, Vrindavan is so powerful. And I'm sure all of us sitting in the room here today, if we're honest, we've all experienced some very strange reactions. Is that correct or not? Yes. You know, when you've got going about your daily activities, we get a bit lusty to do this or that, you know. Mind's thinking, take this, do that, boom, boom, boom. And then the reaction. And that's what Prabhupada said. He said, Vrindavan is like a cauldron. And he says, if you can manage somehow or other to be mindful of all these little pitfalls going about your service daily, and really try to do as much service as you can, regardless of what service it may be, you will generate such a large spiritual bank account. you know? And living in Vrindavan and leaving your body in Vrindavan must be the most wonderful thing that anyone could wish to do, you know? Like I was explaining, we always have to be mindful because we don't really know who's who in the room. And what I mean by that is that we're always used to conversing and communicating through the external energies. We have these material bodies. And we don't see the soul. We don't have the apparatus to see it or to converse with it. But we are people. We are the soul. And what I'm getting at is in Hyderabad, we were in Hyderabad, and we were opening the temple in Hyderabad. There was a devotee called Mahamsa. Do you remember Mahamsa, Swami? Yeah, very nice Indian devotee. Beautiful, yeah. And it was a small little temple, and I remember it was the early days. Dinanath was there, and Yamuna. And you know, in the early days, through Surat, they were doing all the Sankirtan with Prabhupada. And anyway, we ended up in Hyderabad for his opening. And there was a young girl. She was very young. She must have been not even 20 years old. Very young. And she had just joined the temple, and she was there for a few days only. A very sweet young girl. And her sari caught light, and she burned to death. It was a polyester sari, went up like that. And we were all shocked and horrified by what had happened, because we've never seen a devotee die before. Such early, it wasn't old age, you know, it wasn't a natural death. It was like, can you imagine being burnt alive? Because the sari was just, boom, it just went like that. So we were all very distressed about it. And we asked Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, this young girl, she has just come to the temple. She's just been with us a few days, and she's been burned to death in her own sari as an accident. And then, so what happened to that soul? What happened to that devotee? And Prabhupada, he was very silent, and then he said, she went back to Godhead. So
she was thinking of cooking sweet rice.
See? In whatever position you're thinking at the time of death. Yeah. But you see, you just don't know who's who. We come into this world, where do we come from? We don't know. So the point is, we always have to be respectful to one another. It doesn't matter who it is. Humility is the byproduct of being advanced in Krishna consciousness. When you advance in Krishna consciousness, automatically you become humble. And as a result, we then will automatically respect. And Prabhupada says, I'm just thinking now, Krishna's Sava Bhutatma Bhutatma Kurvanapi Na Lipyate, that the devotee is very dear to everyone. You've seen that sloka in the Gita. Sava Bhutatma Bhutatma Kurvanapi Na Lipyate, and everyone is very dear to him. So even from a Krishna conscious point of view, we become Shastra Chakshush. We see everything through the eyes of Shastra. And as a result, that's why Prabhupada gives that depiction in the Bhagavad Gita, where the renounced order of life, the sannyasi, he's standing, and he has the vision of seeing the soul and the super soul together in every living entity's heart, whether it's the elephant, the ant, whatever it is, you know. Okay, I'm going to say this one, but I'm not going to disclose the name of the devotee in case I get in trouble. I put an abbreviation next to each story, and I've got SOH, means sense of humor. Okay, so I was on a morning walk with Srila Prabhupada with maybe another 20-25 disciples of Prabhupada, the God brothers, and we were coming back into the temple. Prabhupada was very, very mindful of time. Prabhupada was so organized. So Prabhupada was time his walk. So as soon as he got back to the temple, he was able to go straight to greet the deity and then sit on the Vyasasam. We'd have Guru Puja and then class, like clockwork, you know. So we greeted the deities, and I remember I was still, after the deities, we'd greet the deities, and then Prabhupada was sitting on his piazza, and we were all looking for the garland to put on Prabhupada, okay? And Dinanath, I saw him, right? Because he was about to lead kirtan. And he also wanted to put the garland on Prabhupada. We all wanted to put garland on Prabhupada, you know? But this time, all of a sudden, devotees were shying away from wanting to take the garland. And I was thinking, why are they shying away? You know, I want to give Prabhupada the garland, you know. So all of a sudden it came like through a chain of, Prabhupada, you take that. It got to me, and I was already within 3 feet of the Vyasasan. But when I looked at the garland, it was all, the edge of the petals were really wilting. Right? And I thought, you sucker. You know, now I know why they're passing the garland. It's like pass the parcel, you know that game? And here I am, I've got the garland, and it's a heavy garland. It's kind of a nice garland. If it wasn't wilted, it would have been beautiful. And I thought, right, there's no other garland around. What do I do? Right? I'm right there, 3 feet away from Prabhupada. He's witnessing the whole thing. Yeah. So I made a decision. It was wrong again. It was a wrong decision. So I went up to Prabhupada, just here, and I went to put it around his neck, and my heart was thumping so loudly I could hear it. Boom, boom, you know, my whole body was like, phew. And Prabhupada looked at me, it was like his face was here, and I was there, and he looked at me and he says, you don't give your spiritual master a garland like that. And he was very grave, you know. He says, you never give your spiritual master a garland like that. So I just stepped back with the garland, and I was looking around, and oh my God, brothers, I don't know where they were. They were like gone somewhere. They were hiding. I was just left there with this garland, and I was thinking, where's the crack in the floor? I need to disappear right now, you know. Oh, I tell you, you know. You learn the hard way, and that was what we did. We always learned the hard way. We were fallen. I'm fallen soul, so you just don't make the right decision, you know. But you learn. Just like Rupa Goswami in the Nectar of Instruction, it says you don't learn, the intelligent man doesn't learn by hearing. And he doesn't even learn by experience, seeing that. And Prabhupada uses the analogy of the thief, you know. And the thief has to be caught to eventually learn that he shouldn't be stealing. So I had to be caught by Prabhupada to learn that I shouldn't be putting a wilted rose garland around his neck, you know. So there you are. That's another story. This is going to be the last story, because this is quite a lengthy story and has a wonderful... Is that all right? I mean, should we be packing up now, do you think?
No, one more.
One more? This is a beautiful story, and you'll see at the end why it is so beautiful. Honestly, it is beautiful. At a point, Prabhupada got really ill in the West, and he came to India. And his devotees were feeling great separation, thinking, is Prabhupada ever going to come back to America? So as a result, there was this one brahmachari, and his name was Rishikesh Brahmachari. Prabhupada initiated him, Rishikesh Brahmachari. And what he decided to do, he was so depressed that Prabhupada not coming, he decided to go to India, where Prabhupada was. So by the time he managed to collect all that money, get his visa, his passport, boom boom, by the time he got to Vrindavan, which is where he was going, Prabhupada had recovered and left. He's gone back to America, so he's stranded. Okay? Now, I don't know the reasons why he remained. I don't know whether he lost his passport. I don't know why he didn't go back, but he didn't. He remained in Vrindavan. And what happened? He took shelter of Prabhupada's godbrother, Bhang Maharaj.
He was drafted after he came on a false passport.
Yeah? Do you know the person I'm talking about? Okay. Okay. Anyway. All right. Anyway. Yeah. Okay. You got it. You got it. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yes. Right. Okay. You've got the story, but I'm going to fill in the gaps, all right? There's not too many, but just to make it an all-round story. So yeah, he learned Hindi, Bengali, he was very learned, he learned a lot of Sanskrit.
He gave the Gita Jayanti talk to Queen Mother in Nepal.
Wow, is that right?
1973.
Wow. Yes, he did live in Nepal as well, yeah. So we used to see him from a distance always. He was always riding around on a rickshaw with his danda and the color of the Gaudiya mat cloth is just slightly lighter than what we use, you know, as a sannyasi or brahmachari. And we were never able to really reach him, to talk to him. He was very elusive, he was like will-o'-the-wisp. He was there one minute, gone the next. Anyway, this one particular time, there was a sannyasi. His name was Devananda. Do you remember Devananda?
Yeah, they were in Nepal together.
Okay, yeah, you got it. You're right on it. Okay. Yeah. So eventually, he was initiated by Balmaraj's Lalitanand Goswami. Yeah. And so he came and started associating with us. And he said, look, I'm so happy to be with my God brothers again. He says, I feel so guilty about what I've done. I want to see Prabhupada. So he wrote to Prabhupada. Prabhupada was in Mayapur. And very quickly a telegram came back. Not a letter, a telegram. And the telegram read that if you want to see me, you come to Mayapur as Rishikesh Brahmachari. So what he did, he got his danda, he took off his sannyas cloth, and he left it in Prabhupada's room at Radha Damodar. And he went to Loy Bazaar and he got a dhoti, a white dhoti, and off he went on the train to meet Prabhupada. And he arrived, and he lay prostrate, dandabats at Prabhupada's feet. I don't know what happened because I wasn't there in Mayapur, but what I do know is the very next day, Prabhupada initiated him as a sannyasi, a Rishikeshananda Goswami, and he gave him his second initiation and his sannyas initiation. Okay? Then, some days later, Rishikeshananda said to Prabhupada, will you translate the Nectar of Instruction? And that's how that book came into being. It was through Rishikesh asking Prabhupada to translate it. Yeah, not Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Nectar of Instruction. Did I say Nectar of?
No.
Yeah, Nectar of Instruction. Yeah, and Prabhupada said yes, and he translated the Nectar of Instruction. What a wonderful book, because it's all about the protocols and etiquettes of Vaishnav relationships, you know. And it's such an important book, also. So that's that story, and it's interesting that you knew. Yeah.
In America, he was a very famous musician.
Wow.
With a group called Children of the Sun.
Okay. No, I didn't know.
And he was a very good singer and very good lyricist.
Okay.
And while he was in Nepal, even in the process of moving, he was still translating Ramanath Das Goswami's poetry.
Mm.
They have me type
them
up.
Wow.
I have no idea what I
was
doing.
He's learning,
though. Take a bicycle for one movie.
Yeah.
Rent a typewriter for one movie.
Wow.
Wow.
It was
very, very astonishing.
I don't know what happened to him now.
He went to the Orient.
He's gone, like, again. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay.
So he was into astrological gems.
Okay. Oh yeah. Yeah, I knew he was into jewelry. Yeah.
But he helped the Thai devotees.
That's nice. That's nice. Yeah. Yeah. Well, what a contribution! I mean, we have this wonderful literature that we all read. Look, there's more stories and they're going to get more intimate. And maybe we'll find another time to do that. One more?
Yes.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay. Oh yeah, this is a good one. After the temple had been opened, maybe it was about 6 months, it was very quiet, and that we weren't having a lot of people coming to the temple. Would you believe that? Look how many people come to the temple now. But in those days, 1975, 6 months on, going into 76, still very quiet, very, very quiet, particularly in the summer. And Yasomati Nandan was here. Prabhupada was here, and Yasomati Nandan was here from Gujarat. And Prabhupada was very concerned that the people weren't filling up the temple. So just down the road in Ramanreti, there was this huge Bhagavat Sapta, 7-day Bhagavatam recital by a Mayavadi sannyasi, but very, very famous in India. So Prabhupada checked in with Yasomati Nandan to ask who that particular person was. Yeah. And what Prabhupada asked Yasomati Nandan to do was, Prabhupada was ready to invite that Mayavad sannyas into the temple to give those Bhagavat Sapta classes so people would come into the temple. Now look at that. He was ready. He didn't even think. Prabhupada wasn't thinking Mayavadi sannyasi, impersonal philosophy, this, that. He just said, let him come to the temple and give his recitation here. And Yasomati Nandan was like, Prabhupada, are you sure you want to do this? Oh yes, you go ask him. Anyway, he went. Yasomati Nandan went to ask this particular, I don't know if he was some sort of an acharya or I don't know, but he refused anyway. He didn't want to go, didn't want to come. But just see Prabhupada, you know, for the sake of wanting people to come to the temple, he was prepared to have a Mayavadi sannyasi come to speak in the temple, you know.
Of course he would make arrangements.
Oh, I'm sure there was an end result to come. There was a conclusion to it all. But that's the spiritual master, you know. You can never second guess what he's doing, what he's prepared to do. And if I'm not, I won't say that. I'll leave that one. Anyway, so that's just another little story, but it's got a lot of meaning to it. There's a lot of meaning to that story. So I think we'll just leave it there and. Hare Krishna, thank you very much for coming.
Do you want to do it again tomorrow, or do you want a break?
It's up to you. I'm happy to carry on.
You want to carry on?
It's just, are you wanting to listen?
Yes, tomorrow.
We're going to go into the intimacy part now.
Yes.
Tomorrow. So, okay. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming.
All right. Thank you.